This is November 28th, 2011. I'm interviewing Mr. Chester Vosburg in Fargo, North Dakota. The interviewer is Stephanie Manassas. All right, Mr. Vosburg, could you tell me a little bit about where you were born and your family growing up?
I was born at Elizabeth, North Dakota. That's on the family farm. And I went to high school, graduated from high school, and Elizabeth High School, and otherwise I was just, I had no other occupation other than farm work prior to my entering the Army.
Hey, can you tell the listeners where Lisbon is, North Dakota?
Well, it's, in fact, it's 76 miles southwest of here.
Okay. And how big was Lisbon when you were raised, approximately?
About 2,000.
About 2,000 people?
And it remains the same.
It remains the same. Okay. Did you have brothers and sisters?
I had five brothers and an infant sister that passed away.
I'm sorry to hear that. How old was your sister when she passed away?
Oh, she was an infant.
Okay. All right. So with all of your brothers, did all of you work on the farm?
Yes. At our own farm or neighbors' farms.
And what year were you born?
1917. March 27, 1917.
Okay. So tell me about the war. Were you drafted or did you enlist in the war?
I enlisted. I enlisted in March 1941 for 1 year. I and a lot of other young fellows of my category didn't have much to do. And so we had a chance to enlist in the Army for 1 year. But of course then Pearl Harbor came along and it was 4 years before we had a chance to get out.
Now, so you enlisted in the Army, is that what you said?
Yes.
In March of 1941, did you think that the United States would join the war?
Oh, no, no idea. I knew, I guess, looking back on it, that there was some rumblings of some kind, but I don't think I knew enough about the world situation to think that we were going to get in any trouble.
Why did you decide to enlist in the Army?
Because there was not... The only other job around where I was farm work, and I figured I had enough of that, and I had no other qualifications. I guess I just hadn't been away from Lisbon to get any idea what the rest of the world was like.
So when you enlisted, you had been working on the farm in Lisbon, on your father's farm?
Well, a neighbor's farm.
So did you have to go, where did you have to go to actually enlist?
Right at Lisbon.
In Lisbon, they had an Army office.
Yes.
Okay, so tell me, what happened after you enlisted?
Well, I and our other buddies went to Fort Warren, Wyoming. That's where our basic training was, and that's where we started our military career.
Did you enlist with some of your friends from high school?
I don't think they were from high school. They were just neighbor friends.
Okay. And so what was the name of it in Wyoming?
Fort Warren.
Fort Warren?
Yes.
So how long were you in boot camp?
Well, we were in boot camp for, back in those days, I think the training was a lot different than it is today. And I don't recall that we were in boot camp maybe for a couple months, maybe.
And then where did you go?
Well, then I, during this period, during 1941, then during the summer, we went on maneuvers to Fort Lewis, Washington, in Fort Lewis, Washington area. And then we returned to Fort Warren, Wyoming, and were there at the time of Pearl Harbor, which was December the 7th, 1941. And then about late least December 1941, then we were ordered back to the Fort Lewis, Washington area, and we thought, sure, we were headed for the Pacific someplace, but we were on guard duty along the coast then for several months.
And what do you do in guard duty?
We just looked and expected to have the Japanese coming in off the coast. We were young guys, we didn't really know or have any idea what might be happening. We were just doing what we were told to.
Was the guard duty pretty boring, day in, day out?
Yes. We were on 4 hours on and 8 hours off. And we had that for 3-4 months, I guess.
Now, during the summer of 1941, you were in, you said, Fort Lewis, Washington?
Yes.
Was there any sense that the United States might be actually making plans to enter the war before Pearl Harbor? Did you have any sense of that at all?
No, none whatsoever.
Okay. So then, after Pearl Harbor, you are in Fort Lewis again on guard duty for about 3 months, you said?
Yes.
And then what was your next step from there?
Then I was in a field artillery unit, and they were reorganizing the troops at that time, and they took part of us from the field artillery unit and made us into a tank destroyer unit, which was supposed to be a special thing of some type. And shortly after we were organized into that, we were then sent to Fort Hood, or Camp Hood, Texas. That was the training center for this new type operation that we started. So we then went to did our training at Camp Hood, Texas.
And what kind of things were they teaching you as a tank destroyer unit?
Well, we had a 75 millimeter cannon, and it was hosed behind the truck. Duty was just as much what I said, tank destroyer. That was going to be our mission, to take on the tank destroyer. Then later on, when we were down at that camp, I keep referring to it as Fort Hood because it's Fort Hood now. But at that time, it was just a spot in the desert. Then we got what was termed half tracks, which was the same type of a weapon, 75 millimeter, mounted on a half track. So that was what we trained with.
So, in other words, your training was meant so that you could actually destroy other tanks,
yes.
Is that it, with the cannons?
Okay.
And what was the second one that you mentioned, the cannons and the...
See, well,
the 75-millimeter cannons, yes. And also what was the second artillery or fire that you mentioned?
Well, the second one I mentioned was that this 75-millimeter weapon that we had was then mounted on a half track.
Okay.
So then we were self-propelled, so to speak.
And what does that mean, a half track, Mr. Vosburgh?
Well, it was the front wheels were like an ordinary vehicle, and then the rear wheels, or the rear area, was a track like they have on a Caterpillar. That's what it was called, half track.
Okay. So you were supposed to be able to shoot the cannons from a half track,
yes.
Is what you're being trained for.
Yeah.
How long were you down in Texas?
Well, Texas. Now we're into early part of 1942. We were in Texas until late 1942.
Okay.
That's when we went overseas.
And where were you sent to first in 1942?
After Camp Hood. Then we went to we were assigned to Fort Dix, New Jersey.
Okay.
That was our stepping off stone.
And from there, did you take off for Africa?
Yes.
Did you go directly to Africa?
Yes.
And where did you go to in Africa?
Casablanca.
Okay. Can you tell me more about what happened when you got to Casablanca?
Well, see, we left Camp Hood on the 24th of December, so we were on board a train Christmas Day, and we got there probably 26th or 27th. And then we boarded our ship. I think it was on about the 7th or 8th of January, that would have been 1943 then.
From Fort Dixon?
Fort Dix.
Fort Dix, I mean, yep.
Fort Dix, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And then we spent, I think it was, I was looking over some notes today, and I think it was about 14 days we were on ship, and we finally landed at Casablanca. But to get things into perspective, the Allies had actually invaded Africa in November of 1942, I believe it was. I think so. They were inland in a ways when we came, and of course we were bombed several times while we were on out in the holding area waiting to get in to land. And finally our turn came, and so we went overboard on a rope ladder down into some landing crafts, and then we got almost to the beach, and then we had to dismount and walk. We waded through water probably up to our knees to get onto the beach, and then we got into an assembly area of them. And we were there actually for several days, and during that period we were waiting and did receive our mechanized equipment that were on other ships. And so they were unloaded, and we finally got them into our encampment and got them ready to go. And we got organized to go.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about your 14-day trip over on the boat, on the ship.
Very, very, not very exciting. And we had, the Navy had us, they had all kinds of ball pin hammers. You know what a ball pin hammer is?
Yep.
And we chipped paint off of the decks of the ships, and of course they repainted them. But that was most of our duties.
They wanted you to chip paint off so it could be repainted?
We did, yeah.
Wow. Were there a lot of fellows that were seasick?
Oh, there were a few, but there wasn't that many.
So when your ship came into harbor, is that when you were in harbor that you were bombed a few times?
Oh, yes.
By other ships?
Enemy aircraft.
Okay, enemy aircraft. Did your ship sustain any damage?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. So that was your first real experience with wars when you were on the ship.
Yes.
Can you tell me how you dealt with the stress of that or how you felt about it?
I don't recall that I was overly worried about it. I just can't explain what kind of feelings I may have had at that time. I don't think I was that crisis, but I'm sure I must have been.
So when you got into the landing craft, you obviously had your own personal gun on you, correct?
Yes.
But you didn't have any of the mechanized equipment until that came later on.
That's right.
So when you got into the landing craft, was there any threat to you from the Axis side at all to get into the assembly line where you assembled?
We were bombed a few times, but nothing real close to us. But then you never knew where one was going to drop.
Okay, so tell me, once you got your mechanized artillery fired and weapons that you needed, what happened after that?
Well, we did some training that was common to the military back in those days, and then we struck out on our errand. But I always say we played cat and mouse on the desert there. There's a lot of sand dunes and other places where enemy could be hiding. And of course, our job was to get them out of there and move on.
In which direction were you going from Casablanca at that point?
We had been going north. We followed the coast. Casablanca was French Morocco, and Algeria was just the next province, I guess you call it, up the coast, and then the final one was Tunisia. And we never did get real far inland, I don't think, as I recall. We were hugging the coast most times.
And so did you move into Algeria?
Oh, sure.
Eventually?
Yes.
Do you know approximately what month that would have been?
Well, let's see. We got there in January, and I'm thinking it would probably have been March, early March.
How prepared were you for the desert conditions?
It was different. It was so much sand, of course, and it was heat, hot. And we had to be very careful with our water supply, and we just survived the heat that was so common.
How hot do you think it got in Fahrenheit there in the winter?
Well, during the winter, I'm thinking there must have been a lot of 80-degree days.
Okay. All right. And how often did you come upon enemy fire?
Our unit was recognized as for our whole campaign now, besides Africa and wherever we continue. And we had over 400 days of combat during our spirit. Of course, that was until 1945.
So between January of 1943 and April of 45 or August of...
VE Day was May 9th, I think, was it? Mm-hmm. 45.
So you had 400 days of combat.
Yes.
Wow.
Our first real test in Africa was that what it was called? Fade Pass. It's FEID Pass. And that was, as the word implies, it was a pass going into the mountains. And the people that were that had gone ahead of us had got to this Fade Pass, and apparently they acted like they were back in maneuvers back in the States. They got their vehicles all lined up and everything just right. And then the Germans, which were up in the mountains, opened fire on them and wiped out their vehicles. So when we came along, then there was just all kinds of burnt out vehicles and And I assume they lost a lot of personnel. And then we moved on through that, and eventually removed the Germans from the pass.
So you were under artillery fire from the Germans when you got to the pass?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Was that your most heaviest time of combat during Africa?
It was hard to say because we had some other skirmishes that were pretty heavy, but this time it was our first experience, of course, and so we were kind of lost as to what to do other than to return fire, and we couldn't actually see somebody just like that to shoot at them. We had to go by gun flashes and areas where we suspected people were, we just kept shooting.
So were all of you traveling in half tracks or in tanks?
Well, I guess I should back off just a little bit. Shortly after we got to Casablanca, they took our half tracks away and gave us a new tank, so to speak. And basically, it looked a lot like our, like the routine tank, other than ours was a 76 millimeter. It was just a little larger weapon, larger projectile. And then a normal tank, of course, has a cover on it. And ours did not. Ours had an open turret. So we just stood and looked out and did our directions that way.
So
we had this new weapon that we, really a good one, and we used it a lot.
So how many tanks would be traveling together typically?
We had three platoons in a company, and each platoon had four tanks. So that would be tank destroyers. So that would be 16 tanks in our company. And then we had three companies in the battalion. So we could have as high as 36 tanks moving, hopefully in one direction.
Okay. And how many men on each tank would you have typically?
Five.
Five men. And were they all open turrets?
Oh, yes. Well, let's see. We had a driver, assistant driver, and we had what we call a loader, the guy that slammed the cart with the projectile into the breech. And then we had the gunner, and then there was the tank commander.
And is that what you were, was the tank commander?
Yes.
Okay, so at what point had you been promoted to tank commander?
Oh, shortly after, when we got to Africa.
Okay.
I really had no more knowledge than anybody else did. We were all greenheads, and somehow or another I became a tank commander.
So as tank commander, you would tell the gunner when to go ahead and let fire?
Yeah.
Okay. So when you were in Texas training under being a destroyer of tanks, were you primarily doing the gunning position, or what position were you primarily in?
Oh, I think we rotated.
In all four positions?
Yes.
Besides the commander?
Yes.
Okay. So you became the tank commander. How did you feel about being in such a position of responsibility with no actual hands-on training?
Well, I don't know. I just looked upon it as a job that had to be done, and somehow or another I got through with it okay. I eventually became, then I became a platoon commander, which meant that I had four tanks to look after. So, I don't know, I just somehow was able to get into the way things are supposed to be done. And I think I did all right.
I bet you did. As tank commander, did you always have the same four men with you, assuming nothing happened to them?
Yes.
And why was there a decision to put you in tanks with just open turrets?
I have no idea. This vehicle that we had then was a new concept in the Army. And it was, the title of the tank was, a tank destroyer. That was something new as far as the Army was concerned. And they had never had that before. And of course they had all kinds of tanks, but they had a smaller weapon. And of course they were totally enclosed. And we had a bigger vehicle to do business with.
Now, didn't you feel awfully vulnerable, though, not being enclosed when you were in the midst of fire?
I can't remember being that shook up about it. Naturally, you ducked down as much as you could, but I don't know. I didn't think that we were that. We had. A lot of times, you know, we use the high explosive projectiles, and there were high explosive projectiles coming into us, and of course they would shatter up in the sky airways, and of course you always had the problem of some of that stuff coming down on you, you know. And ours was the same way, going well out. Advantage we had was the open source was that you could see all around you, you know. Where an ordinary tank, they were locked into this thing with the hood over it, not locked, but they were in there. And so all they had was a little periscope to search the area with, where we had our eyes right out the open.
That makes sense. Okay, when you guys arrived at Fade Pass, you said it was?
Yeah.
How many tanks on your side were there when you arrived?
Well, I suppose we had our whole battalion, so it would have been about 36 tanks.
Your whole battalion?
Yeah.
Okay, so now, were you actually kind of down and below on the bottom of a pass?
Yes.
Were there mountains on both sides?
Yes.
So were there Germans on both sides?
As I recall, there was, yeah. But there was rocks and cliffs, you know.
And they were shooting at you with both cannons and with machine guns and rifles, I'm assuming.
Yes. Well, of course, we weren't that excited about the machine guns and the rifles because we were out of their range.
Okay.
So so we got real close, you know, but then they had vacated the premises by the time when we got up there.
When you say up there, you mean up to the top of the mountain?
We never did go to the top of the mountains. We were on the valley below, but we were shooting up at the top of the mountains, you know, wherever there was this suspicion that there might be somebody holed up in there. We fired a couple of rounds in there.
And then you're saying after a certain point in time, the Germans left because
yes.
They realized they weren't a match for you. How far is the range for machine guns and rifles?
Oh, gee. Well, I guess a couple hundred yards, probably.
Okay. And they were much farther away from you than that?
Oh, yes, yeah.
And when you came upon the scene of the other tanks that had been destroyed, were there any men that needed to get medical care?
No, it was just a burnt-out area. There was nothing there.
Okay. So you don't know if any men survived and
no.
left on further tanks or not?
No. I'm sure there were casualties.
Tell me, after you went through Fade Pass, what happened?
Well, we just kept moving up the coastline, of course, through out of French Morocco into Algeria and on up the coast. You know, that really wasn't that long a campaign. We didn't get involved in it until, as I say, I think it was March and March, and the African campaign was over with on May the 9th. I'll never forget that day, that Mother's Day. Nice. It'll be on the 8th then, the 8th of May. They were making one last big push to capture Tunis. And so during the day we had maneuvers around and fired a lot of shells. Late in the afternoon, our tank, we ran out of ammunition. And I thought, well, you know, our work is done for the period, but they wanted everybody to, regardless of whether they had ammunition or not, to make a show of force to make the final push. So we were in that final push. And long about, it was dusk, I guess, or a little later, then our tank got hit, and shell came in right back of us first, where I was standing, and none of us got hurt, but of course our tank was disabled, and we bailed out of the tank, and ran into a little ditch, and there was a German laying there with his hands up in the air, wanting to surrender. And we didn't have any weapons then, because we had just jumped out, you know. So I beat it back to the tank. It was smoking, but it wasn't blazing. And there was they had a fire extinguisher system on it. So I reached over the shirt and pulled that. And then I got a weapon out of the that we had fastened alongside of the shirt, right where I stood. We had a carbine. So I got that, so we had one weapon, and we went back to the ditch. And there we were practically all night. Everything moved on, of course. We were left there by ourselves. And finally, towards morning, one of our rear echelon people came to our aid and took us back to the rear echelon, to the camp. And of course, then that was the morning of the 9th. And sometime during that morning, then the word came that the Germans had surrendered, and but we could still, because there was still a unit up there ahead of them or someplace that were still, hadn't gotten the word. So they, one of our lieutenants got into what they called a light tank, which was really nothing much in it. Than a vehicle with a machine gun on it, and tied a white flag onto the aerial of the radio, and they went up to this encampment that were still fighting, and gave them the words that the Germans had surrendered. So then all firing ceased, and then as I remember, that was probably mid-morning. And then along about noon or mid-afternoon, then the Germans just came streaming by the hundreds down the surrenders. And of course, just run it to us and everybody else who was around there. And they had a, apparently had a prison camp set up someplace, or were setting one up, because all of these German prisoners had to go someplace, and we were taking care of them.
Okay, so tell me, that's a very, thank you for sharing that. When you were in the ditch with the German, did you spend the whole night in the ditch with the German?
Yes.
And so he was just basically there being surrendering with you guys?
Yes. Well, it just so happened that one of our crew members spoke very fluent German. So he told us that the war was going to be, over with that night. Somehow or other, I don't know what position he held or how he arrived at the ditch, but he was there. And he seemed to know that this was going to be over with. And sure enough, during the night that we could see just all kinds of explosions off in the distance. And of course it was the Germans blowing up their ammunition dumps and destroying their vehicles and anything that we could possibly use.
So the German man in the ditch already knew that the war was coming to a close, at least in the African front.
Yes, yes.
He knew that. So then now, in the next morning when you took off, where did you take him in that morning?
I don't recall. We just handed him off to somebody else who apparently took him to the prison camp, I suppose. And I imagine he being a single individual there and one of the early ones, I just imagine they wanted to interrogate him a little bit. I don't know. I never did know what happened to him.
And when the lieutenant, you said, went ahead with the white flag to forewarn the other people that they had already surrendered, the Germans.
Yes.
How many tanks, how many tanks were up in front of the American or Allied tanks?
No idea.
Okay. Now, were you in the city of Tunis at this point?
No, we never did get into the, we just got into the outskirts of Tunis.
Okay.
We never did get into the heart of it.
Okay. So when you were on the tank, you guys did not then obviously have your own rifle slung across you.
No.
And did you have individual rifles in the tank if
yes.
you needed them?
Yes.
And so when you said you grabbed a carbine, is that a type of rifle?
Yes, it's a rifle, yeah.
Okay, so when you were in the ditch, it was just one rifle,
yeah.
Your three or four camarades, and then the German man.
Yes.
Okay, and then you later got back into another tank for show of force, or that was earlier before your tank was, disabled,
yes,
correct?
Yes.
Okay, so after the next morning when you got out of the ditch, were you on foot at that point, or somebody came in and got you in a vehicle?
Oh, they came and got us in a vehicle. They had what was every unit had what was called a tank retriever, which was almost another tank, really, but it was geared up to where they could hook onto another tank and pull you. So they were salvaging our tank also.
So now, you said that there were four tanks in each unit, is that correct?
Yes.
And so they would also have a tank retriever, like was another vehicle, but it wasn't a
yes.
tank?
That was in the headquarters.
In the headquarters?
Yes.
So it wasn't necessarily going along with each unit.
Oh, no.
Got it. So, but it would come out to save, get men that were had tanks that were disabled?
Yes.
And or to take disabled tanks somewhere else to be repaired, is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. Tell me about your reaction when you saw that there was a German in the ditch.
I guess I couldn't tell you. We were just dumbfounded to see somebody with his arms up, wanting to surrender, and we had no idea where he came from or what he was doing there.
And when you ran back to get a rifle, were you concerned that he might have been armed?
I don't think I was at that time, because the other guys would have been watching over him.
Okay. All right, so just to explain one more time, so the next morning, then what did you call the vehicle that would pick up?
retriever.
The retriever came along and got you guys and your tank. Is that correct? So you just got back into the tank and you were pulled?
Well, yes. We were pulled back to our main headquarters.
And your main headquarters were in the outskirts of Tunis?
Well, it was, no, it was, well, yes, it would have been, but this was, you know, when I talk about our main headquarters, it was our rear echelon, where every unit always had a rear echelon that follows you. And they had these retrievers and the cooks and the cook wagons and ammunition trucks and any other supplies that was needed.
And so they were always in the rear.
Oh, yeah.
And so I have to think of a question I had, Mr. Vosberg. Hold on. Okay, so when you got into the, I'm sorry, tell me the name of the vehicle again that came and got you.
Retriever.
When you got in the Retriever, then they took you to the rear echelon where all the vehicles were at that point. What did you think about what the German told you about the war being over the next day when you didn't know that was actually the case? Did you have any faith or belief in what he said?
Well, when I look back on it, not at the time, I don't think we did. But when I look back on it and think of all of the explosions we've seen in on the horizons and whatnot, that we come to realize that he must have had some idea of what was going on.
Did you know if he was an officer or not?
No, I don't know either.
Okay. So tell me what happened on May 9th after the Germans surrendered. What happened?
Well, of course, we were virtually celebrating, you know, and it was such a relief to be, not to be under a constant strain anymore, and I don't know, we were just jubilant.
Did you actually go into town to celebrate?
Oh, no.
You were still on the outskirts of town?
Oh, yes, yeah. No, we were still in our own little compound, you know.
Okay, and for how long were you celebrating for?
When I say celebrating, I don't mean celebrating like we do today. It was just sitting around and probably playing cards or something, and not having the strain of worrying of something going to come in at you. Big part was having a hot meal. You know, the kitchen was able to cook up a meal, and we'd been living on what they called C rations and K rations before, which was okay, but it was a canned thing. You know.
Was that the first time you had your hot meal from leaving Casablanca?
Oh, no, some places along the line we could get a hot meal once in a while.
But it was a rarity.
Oh, yeah.
How long were you at the compound before you moved again?
I suppose we remained in that area a month or more. And then, of course, we had to prepare for going to Italy. And we had some more training to do. But I can remember us going out to the seashore and wading around in the sea, you know, so we were very, very, very close to the Mediterranean Sea.
So were you close enough to go daily if you had time off?
Oh, I don't think we were that close. As I remember, they would take a bunch of us out in a truck.
And so during that month time frame, did you know in the very beginning that you were going to Italy, or was it unclear as to what your future held for you?
I don't think we had any idea where we were going.
Did you have hopes that you would return back to the States?
Oh, yes. We thought the war was over with, you know, and actually it was just beginning.
Okay, that makes sense. So obviously in your small world, because the Germans surrendered, you thought that the war was over with.
Yep.
And when did it become clear that the war was not over with and you guys might have another tour of duty?
Oh, I think it was probably within a month or two, you know, when we were doing more training. And of course they were, trying to orient us a little bit on what Italy might be like, and keeping us posted on the war in Germany anyway, you know. So we pretty much, I guess, you know, after a month or so, I think we probably just pretty much realized that we weren't going home right then.
How did you feel at that point when you realized that?
I guess you know, I was thinking of my parents a lot, because at that time there was four of us from our family that was in the military all overseas in a dangerous way, and there they were just by themselves out on the farm. And I'm sure they must have been worried about what was happening to us. And we didn't have the means of corresponding like they had today. And I'm not saying that that's such a great thing, but you know, our means of corresponding was what they called V-mail, which was a little skinny sheet of paper that you could write your message on and address it and give us this. Some section, and they see that flowing back to the United States.
How big was the V-mail? About how much room was on there?
Oh, it was a. It wasn't an 8x11, but it must have been probably 8x6, which folded over.
Okay.
And you wrote your message in there and folded it. Addressed it. No postage necessary, of course.
So you could have just the inside of that 8-inch six-inch piece of paper to write on.
You didn't have that much to write about, really, because you weren't supposed to tell about your experiences.
Because everything was censored.
Yeah.
How often did you get a chance to write to your family?
Oh, you could write. I tried to make it a point to write. Once a week, maybe. But a lot of times I couldn't, of course, but I tried to keep in touch with them.
So tell me, out of your brothers, which brother was the one that stayed home to help out on the farm?
It was the oldest, my oldest brother.
And did he stay home because he chose to, or because he couldn't go into the military?
Well, he got married, and then he started his own farm. And so he was exempt, deferred.
If you have your own farm, you're exempt from going into the military?
Yes, yeah. Farm was an important thing. Farming was an important thing in our nation. And that was one of the categories that were, I wouldn't say exempt, but they were deferred. And so Walt he'd gotten married for one thing, and then had his farm, and then had a child, so he had a lot of deferments.
So was Walt's farm right next to your parents' farm?
Well, 3-4 miles, I guess.
So your father was by himself doing farming?
Yeah.
Now, your three brothers, all of them were single when they joined the military?
Yes.
And in those days, there was no maximum number of siblings that could go in, correct?
No. No, as far as I knew, I think there was some stipulation that two members of a family weren't supposed to serve in the same unit. I think there was something to that effect. but there was, you know, there was a story of some Navy group, I think they were from Iowa, or probably, where three brothers were on the ship and were all killed. But otherwise, I just wasn't aware of it.
And your three brothers, you enlisted. Did any of your brothers enlist, or were they all drafted?
They were all drafted.
And did they all make it out of World War II?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to come back and ask you some questions a little bit later about your brothers, okay?
Okay.
I'm glad that they all made it. Going back to the V-mail, because you were always on the move in the desert, how often could you actually receive letters from your family?
Oh, gee, that would be, I don't know, mail call was an awful, awful important thing. I think there probably was somebody getting some mail every week, really. You know, somebody in our group was getting mail from somebody. Not meaning that, like me, for example, would be getting a letter every week or something like that. But some of our comrades were getting some mail.
And just your platoon, you're saying?
Yeah, or our company, yeah.
Okay. So do you remember receiving any letters between March and May when you were actually on the move in the desert?
No, I don't really remember.
Okay, so you are now in June, moving into July. At this point, you're aware of the fact that you're going to Italy.
Yes.
What did you know at that time about how Germany was doing in the war and what was going on the European front?
Well, we had, we had the Stars and Stripes magazine. And, of course, I don't recall that they ever gave much negative reporting. I think it was kind of an uplifting magazine that tried to keep you feeling good about the advances that we were making, you know. And again, you know, that was a whole new world to us, and we didn't, or at least I didn't, and I'm sure the majority of us didn't realize where all of these countries were. And when I think of what's happening today, we knew that just on the other side of the mountains in Africa, that General Rommel was being pushed back up through Libya and whatnot. I never even realized where Libya was, you know. I never heard of it. And so, for geography purposes, I guess, you know, most of us just never realized what the world was like. No idea.
Which makes sense.
Yeah.
What was your most memorable experience in Africa besides your tank getting hit? What was the second most memorable experience?
I guess being part of it, just hearing of the German surrendering.
Okay.
I can remember that just being a real uplifting thing, you know. We just, that all blossomed out.
Especially when you also thought it was the end of the war,
yes,
as well.
Yeah.
When you came across Germans in the desert, was it often just a few tanks sometimes where you'd have a skirmish with a few tanks at a time?
Yes. Yeah.
Hear anything about Rommel at all when you were in Tunis, or did you hear about him later on?
No. We got to the Stars and Stripes fairly often. I suppose, every couple of weeks or something like that. And they, you know, so we were aware of the British chasing Rommel up on Egypt and Libya.
Now, when you were in the compound, was it only Americans that were there?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Okay, did you ever come across any British at all? Or French?
I think, as I recall, one time the British were going to get some of the equipment like we had. So we were to train them, which we did.
When you were at the compound, you helped
yeah.
train some of the British. Tell me about when you guys left Tunis to go for Italy, to go to Italy.
Well, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I can't remember the ports that we left from. I would think it was Algiers, but I could be mistaken. That would be down the coast quite a ways. We must have left from some port just outside of Tunis for Italy.
Did you go to Sicily first?
No, we didn't go to Sicily.
Where did you go?
We landed at Salerno.
Okay. So how was the boat ride?
It was. We were on a British ship, and they were famous for their mutton stew, and that's what we lived on. And so we were glad to get off of it.
You didn't like the mutton stew?
Oh, no.
I've never had mutton stew. Is it really bad or what?
Well, I suppose if it was made right, it would be okay, but that wasn't.
Okay, so how long were you on the ship?
Oh, I think we must have been on there 3-4 days. And in fact, when we got to Salerno, it was similar to what was at Casablanca. We couldn't get into the unloading area. So it was an extra day or so. And again, we had to go over the side of the ship on a rope ladder and into the landing crafts and then into Salerno.
Now, were there British troops on the ship with you, or was it only Americans?
No, well, there was British, I don't think there was British employees. I don't recall there being any actual British soldiers. But I'm sure that, you know, there was a British ship, so I suppose their crew was all British.
So you got into Salerno, you were out at bay for a little while before you could actually go into the port. And then what happened once you got onto the landing crafts?
Well, then we had to go into the beach and had to wade in a little ways, you know. And then our equipment, we didn't have to wait very long. The next day or so our equipment came on another ship, of course. So we were ready to do business again.
Back with your tanks.
Yep.
Now, this was in July of 1943?
The invasion of Italy and Salerno was I don't think I'm mixed up on my dates. I think the invasion of Italy and Salerno was in September.
September of 1943.
Yes.
Okay, so you got your equipment from the other ship.
Yes.
But you weren't in skirmishes right away.
Not right away.
Okay, so tell me what happened after you got your tanks.
Well, then of course, then we were reorganized, so to speak, and we had a mission to accomplish, and in a couple of days we were in business, so to speak.
Right, were you in artillery fire right in Salerno or around Salerno?
Around Salerno, yes. But after that, see, we came in a day or two after the actual invasion. So they were in a ways again before we arrived.
Into the countryside,
yes,
you mean, or into the countryside?
Yeah.
So you joined the other troops that were in the countryside.
Yeah.
And how long were you in Salerno area?
Very, very short time, a day or two. And then we were moving up towards Naples and Cassino. I'm sure you've heard of Cassino, Mount Cassino. And so we spent a lot of time there trying to advance, and we couldn't.
So how long were you in Naples? Were you just passing by Naples?
Just passing through, really.
Okay. So tell me more about Mount Cassino.
Well, there was a city, a village of Cassino, and right above us on a mountain peak was an abbey, and that was called Mount Cassino. And we were of the impression that, and I'm sure we were right, that the Germans were using that as an observation point. And we were prohibited from firing on the abbey on account of it being a religious operation. And so we were stymied there for a long time. And we always had the feeling that they knew what we were doing down below. I guess that's another event that I'll never forget. This fighter bomber came over, and he was just diving down, you know. And I thought, isn't he ever going to pull out, you know? And he got real close to the abbey, and he dropped his bomb. And of course, then we opened fire too, and pretty much demolished the abbey, and then we were able to move on north because their observation point was destroyed.
So it was an American bomber pilot or British? It was American.
Yeah.
Destroyed the abbey.
Yeah. Well, he was one of the first ones, and then there were several bombers came in afterwards.
Okay. Do you have any idea if they intentionally bombed the abbey?
Oh, I'm sure they did.
Okay. So they probably had some sort of intelligence that said that there was Germans up there.
Yeah.
So how many days between when you got to Mount Cassino, approximately, and the abbey was bombed?
I'm sure we were there a couple weeks or more.
Were there skirmishes going on
yes.
every day?
Yes.
And where were the Germans at that point, besides in the abbey?
Well, they were in the village of the Cassino also. So we had tried to go through the village a time or two, but they were always able to attack us from the sides, you know. So we just had to withdraw two or three times.
And was it mostly Italians or Italians and Germans that you were fighting? Did you know?
Oh, I don't think there was many Italians. I think we were mostly Germans.
At that point?
Yeah.
Okay. So once the abbey was bombed, then it gave you guys the ability to move forward.
Right.
Where did you go after that?
Well, we worked then our way up to... We spent most of the winter. That would have been in 44 then, the end of 44, and we spent most of the winter trying to move north, and we were pretty much stymied because. And when the spring broke out, we finally got some moving because we went into, we got into Rome on June the 4th, I think it was. That was D-Day. We had gotten into Rome like this afternoon, and we kind of made made our camps around there. And of course, the natives were greeting us with wine and all kinds of stuff. And the next morning, when we were to move out, there was just a real uproar. And we thought that the Germans were counterattacking. But it was the Italians that got the words that it came up with. That's was D-Day, the invasion of Normandy. And that's what they were shouting about. And that's the first we knew about it, as the heads of Rome.
Now, the Italians officially surrendered in what month?
I couldn't tell you.
It was officially, wasn't in 1943, but there were still skirmishes
yes.
into 1944, correct?
Yes. Oh, yes.
So when you came into Rome and there was all of this, was it a celebration or what was it?
Oh, yes, it was a celebration. They were.
So they were celebrating for the Allied troops?
Yes.
And that's when you found out about D-Day?
Yes.
Tell me more about what you found out about D-Day in June of 1944.
Well, again, I guess we got the impression that the war was going to be over with, so I said that. Because we were able to move north of Rome then, relatively easy, I guess. It wasn't a cakewalk, but it was easier than what we had been having. We got up as far as Florence, that is where, is as far as we went, basically, before we came back, and then went into southern France.
So this was the second time that you thought the war was over with?
Yes, yeah. And every reason to believe it, you know.
And how long did you say you stayed in Rome, approximately?
Oh, just hardly 24 hours.
Okay. And then when you left Rome, you still thought the war was almost over?
Yes. Because we seemed to have easier going. The Germans were not resisting as much. They were pulling out, going north. And I don't know whether they were trying to get back to their homeland or Mussolini was still alive. So they were trying to get up into his territory in northern Italy, but I don't remember exactly what the situation was. But we got as far as Florence, and then we came back to Naples and boarded the landing crafts and went into southern France.
So between Rome and Florence, do you know how approximately how many days it took you to move between Rome and Florence?
Oh, I think that was June the 4th, and I imagine it was a month or 6 weeks or more.
Did you come across very much German resistance at all in that?
Oh, there was always resistance, but not the diehard that had been up until Rome.
Okay. What was your most memorable experience in Italy?
I guess just the fact of getting into Rome. We'd always heard about Rome, but as a country boy, I didn't know anything about it.
What did you think of Rome?
Well, what little I seen of it. It was just a bunch of enjoyable people. Everybody had a relative in Chicago or New York or something, and they wanted to know if you knew them, you know.
So you came across some Italians that spoke English?
Oh, yes, yeah. There was a lot of them.
Were any of the men in your company at all Italian descent and spoke Italian?
Yes, there were a couple.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me more about the bombing of Mount Cassino. What do you remember about it?
Well, as I stated earlier, this single bomber dive bomber came, and he just kept coming down and down and down, and I thought, you know, is he going to crash into that place? And then he dropped his bomb and took off. And then shortly after that, several bombers came, and they just pulverized the place.
And at this point, were you convinced that there was Germans up in the Abbey?
Oh, we were always convinced that they had a lookout, and they had an observation point there.
Do you think there was any monks living in the Abbey at the time?
I've read some stuff afterwards that there were some monks and some nuns up there that survived. As I understand it, they have rebuilt it. I don't know if that's true or not, but I think they've rebuilt it.
And what was the town of Mount Cassino like at that time?
It was just a little country village, really. It was no big city, no big deal.
Did you come across any Italians in your day-to-day existence there? Not troops, but just regular, everyday Italians?
Oh, yes. There would be always some. And that happened wherever you were. You wondered why these people were wandering through the area. It was very dangerous, you know. But they had to live, and so they were scrounging and going about their business, forgetting about the war.
What was your impression of how the people were doing economically in that town?
I'm sure they must have just had a tough time. I don't know. We did a lot of business, so to speak. We got wine. We had a lot of wine, and as I remember, we ate rabbits quite often, just in our own crew, and so we had to negotiate for them, either negotiate or just take us. And most of the time we negotiated, we were fair with, well, you know, everybody wanted cigarettes, and we had all kinds of cigarettes, so we could trade cigarettes.
So you would trade a lot of cigarettes with the Italian civilians for rabbit?
And wine.
Yeah. And how were your interactions with the Italians?
Well, those kind of people, we got along okay with them. I don't think the Italians were really wanting to fight. I don't think they were interested in the war. The Germans were, of course, but I don't think the Italians as a whole wanted to fight very much. Well, that was a known fact. They just gave up.
Could you just describe to me a little bit more about what the sentiment was of the Italian people when you came to Rome on June 6th?
They were just so happy. we had stayed, we got into Rome in the evening. And so we bivouacked there overnight, and the next morning we were preparing to move on north, and there was all of this uprising. People were shouting and hauling out wine, and just were so happy. And then we discovered that somebody had a radio and had heard that the invasion of Normandy went on. That's what all the excitement was about. And of course, we were happy too.
So they were celebrating more D-Day than they were the arrival of your troops?
Oh, I would think that it was probably about 50-50.
Okay. And at this point, did you think that the war was pretty much coming to a close?
Oh, yes. We always thought, well, that's, you know, it won't be long now. But it didn't turn out that way.
Okay. So tell me about what, did you have any one-on-one interactions with any Italians in Rome?
Oh, certainly. We drank plenty of their wine, and of course we had a lot of cigarettes, so we could pass out some cigarettes, and of course there was any number of people that had kinfolk in Chicago, and I remember this, that they always wanted to know whether we happened to know them there in Chicago, but they were just joyful people.
Did very many of them speak English?
No.
So it was very limited conversations?
Oh, yes.
Okay. And you said you had a couple Italian Americans that were in your company?
Yes.
And did they speak some Italian?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, they were interpreters.
Okay. So how long were you in Rome then?
Oh, just about 24 hours, I suppose.
Okay. Tell me about your campaign going north in Italy.
Well, it was a very slow operation, of course. The Germans were pretty well fortified along the way, and so we just didn't make much. We didn't make much ground. I can't remember. We got up as far as Florence, as far as we went after we left Rome. Got up as far as Florence, and then we came back a ways towards Naples, as I believe, and that's when we boarded the landing craft to go into Marseille.
And at that point when you were on the landing craft to go to Marseille, did you have any idea of what was in store for you in France?
No, no. Other than we just knew that there was going to be more combat. But really, we down in the lower echelon, of course, had no knowledge of what was the big picture was.
Now, were you a platoon commander at this point?
Yes.
When did you become a platoon commander?
Oh, it was someplace after we left Rome. Our platoon leader was wounded, and then I just stepped into his place.
And did he eventually make it out okay?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Did he come back to fight with you?
He came back with us, yes.
He did. So you became the platoon leader.
Yes.
And how many men were in your platoon, approximately?
Well, there would be five in each tank. And we had four tanks in a platoon, and there were three platoons, so there'd be 12, 12 tanks. And that's about, so five, then there'd be 60 men.
60 men?
We weren't always up to full complement, of course.
Okay.
But maybe around 50, I guess.
So you were in charge of that number of men?
Yes.
How did you feel about having that new position?
I guess I never gave it any thought. It was just, I always looked upon it as something that needed to be done. And we did it.
Okay.
I never gave it any second thought. But of course, I was always happy when I was promoted. But I guess I didn't strive for any, didn't have any goal of getting how far up in the ranks. I eventually became the first sergeant of the company, which was the top sergeant of the company.
So after platoon leader, what's the next one, staff sergeant, or?
Well, platoon leader, I was a staff sergeant. Then I went up to a first sergeant.
Okay, and when did that happen?
Oh, gosh, I don't remember exactly when that was. The coast there went out too much trouble.
And where did you first encounter resistance from the Germans?
Oh, gee, I don't really know. It was just very few days after we landed in Marseille, and I don't remember exactly when that was.
Okay. And so, did you have a lot of resistance when you were in the southern part of France?
Yes, just annoying resistance. We didn't have that, there was no big pitched battle.
So how would you describe annoying resistance?
Somebody's taking a pot shot at you periodically, and you're not being able to return the fire simply because we didn't know where it came from.
So did the fighting become more in terms of battles? Was that more when you got closer to the Belgium-German border?
Yes.
Okay, so it was up closer in kind of the north east corner of France.
Yes, it would have been, yes.
So tell me more about what happened then.
Well, it was just a day-to-day operation, and we were supporting infantry, so there was a mixture of us all the time, and it was just the objective, of course, of gaining some ground.
So now, if my memory serves me right, and when the Battle of the Bulge was going on in Belgium, you guys were in northeast France, is
yes.
that correct?
Yes.
So can you tell me a little bit strategically about how that was working? Were you trying to keep the Germans occupied down there from going into Belgium, or?
Well, I think we were. we were, this was in the wintertime, and of course we were kind of stymied as far as movement was concerned. But it was, we were not gaining much ground, that's for sure. But we did a lot of what we called indirect firing, in which we guessed somebody was up there in a certain spot, and we pour some shells in there.
Did you know about the Battle of the Bulge was actually happening at the same time, or were you not aware of it at the time?
I don't think we were really aware of it. No.
Tell me about the conditions during the winter. Were you guys, did you have winter clothing?
Oh, yes, we had winter clothing, yeah. But it was, you know, we had no chance to shower, for example. One thing that I can remember is that there was a lot of trench foot, which meant that we needed clean socks, and that was one of the things that came up with our rations periodically, was a bunch of new socks to keep our feet dry and keep them from being infected.
So trench foot is basically an infection that you would get from wet, cold feet?
Yes.
How many men would get that?
Oh, there was, I don't recall our specific group having more than a half a dozen or so, but the people that were really affected were the infantry people, because they were on foot all the time, and their feet got wet, they had no choice, there was nothing they could do about it. Where we were in a tank, and our feet was not so apt, we weren't so apt to be wet. We stayed in our tank.
Now, could the trench foot take people out of combat? It was so serious.
Yes, they would go back to the what we call the rear echelon, where the medics were, and they would treat them for that. But they would come back. I don't remember how long it would take to treat somebody on it, but they would eventually come back to the unit.
And so do you remember approximately, was it in January or February that you moved into German, where you crossed the German line of 45?
Oh, I'm sure it probably was in, let's see, it was over, 45, it was over within May.
What, 45.
So I suppose it was probably January. Germany.
Now, with it just being all the terrain looking the same, were you aware of the fact that you were actually into Germany? Would the higher ups tell you that you had made it Germany?
Yes, yes. We would we would be given a routine map of some type, just not one that was not like a road map for us to go a certain way, but it was a kind of more of a map of telling us what we'd accomplished, where we were at. So we didn't have the company commander, of course, had a map of the whole area and where we were at. But we in the lower ranks didn't know.
Now, did you, as a platoon commander, did you lose any men of your platoon when you were in the French-German side fighting?
Yes, we lost one of our tank commanders was lost. He panicked. We were under fire, and. We don't know for sure, but he apparently panicked, and he jumped out of the tank, and of course he was shot then. You know. And we lost a couple guys from our tanks, our group of tanks, you know, that had gotten into some bad firepower. Tried to escape from the tank, which was a bad idea, and they got mowed down.
So leaving the tank was always dangerous, unless it was ready to go off into fire.
Yes, that was your safest place. Is in the tank.
Is in the tank, and you still had no turrets on your tanks at this point. But could you duck down?
Oh, sure.
Okay, so you could duck down into the tank.
Yeah.
How did you deal with losing some men in your platoon?
Well, boy, that's a hard, you know, it was a sad day, naturally, but there was not a thing we could do about it. And of course, we had welcomed the replacement, but when we lost somebody, it was just one of those things that was expected overall, you know, and we just carried on.
And tell me about the replacements. My understanding is that in World War II, a lot of times the men in a company or a platoon, for example, would be nervous about a replacement because they didn't know if they could really count on them.
Well, I guess that was true in some respect, but we have to stop and think that some of these replacements, 60 days earlier, they were civilians. You know, they had no choice in where they were going to come. I don't think we ever had any problem with questioning their capabilities.
Do you have any memorable days when you were fighting in France or along the German border at all?
Not really. It was just one day was the same as the next. Same as the past day.
Were you under artillery fire almost every day when you were by the German border?
Oh, I think during that winter we were under fire an awful lot.
And when did things start to ease up for you?
Well, I guess it must have been, probably was in early May then when we started gaining some ground, capturing a lot of prisoners, and not meeting as much resistance as we had in the days past.
So, do you remember when you were in the German? So, you were in the German border, maybe January, February timeframe. Does that sound about right?
Yes.
And then between February, May, were you just moving into Germany?
Yes.
Do you remember any memorable experiences about that?
Well, I remember us crossing a river, and I should know the river, but I don't. It might have been the Rhine, it possibly was. But the engineers had put a floating bridge across, and of course we crossed in further into Germany on the, I can't remember the name of that bridge that they made. The engineers made it.
Did you have to wait at the river for a while to go over, or were you able to go over immediately?
Oh, no. It was a wait-and-see attitude there for a while.
To see if you were under any kind of fire? Were you under fire trying to cross the river?
Well, we were naturally. The Germans were just on the other side of the river, and their objective was to keep us from establishing a foothold on the other side of the river. So there was naturally a lot of fire going on.
Now, my understanding is towards the end of the war, at about that time, the Germans were using a lot of older men and young boys to fight. Were you aware of this, or was it because
I don't think we were. I think we were just involved with what you might call a normal military man.
Okay. So, do you remember the day that you heard that Hitler died?
No.
Okay, so May 8th, you were in Austria.
Yes.
And so, tell me a little bit more about Austria.
Well, it was just it's just a beautiful country. Just a beautiful country. The mountains, the snow caps, of course, and the villages were the true Austrian style, I guess you would call them. You know, they were. I don't recall any large city. There were several small cities that we went through, and their family houses were. I don't know how to describe it, but they were more of the mountain type, you know. I've seen any number of pictures of the Austrian Alps and their communities up there. So it was, as I recall, if I were to go back there now, I'd say it was a very beautiful place.
Were there any other Allied troops there besides Americans where you were?
No.
And how did the Austrians respond to having you there?
As I recall, they were very friendly, and of course we were friendly to them. And I guess I could see their feelings about us because. We were at that point of the system. We were able to put out our perimeter guards, and then the rest of us could relax. And of course, we were relaxed in their farmhouses, slept in their beds, and but of course we gave them. We had all kinds of coffee and cigarettes, so. You know, we gave some to them when they were out. This German lad that we had in our outfit, he got very involved with, I don't know if that's the term to use, went with a family that where we occupied their household, and they had, in fact, they had three daughters, I think. And these guys communicated back and forth, and even after the war, our friend's name was Grundhofer, corresponded with those people over there. And they had a pretty much of an annual newsletter that went back and forth. So they were friends of ours.
So he kept in contact on a yearly basis with his Austrian family.
Yes, yeah, but he's been deceased a few years now, so I don't have any. But I remember the people as being quite friendly, you know, and I think they were anti-Nazi. In fact, one guy tipped us, and I probably told you this, tipped us off as one of the Nazi members there had a car that was stored under a bunch of hay in their barn. And so we brought the car out and painted it army green and put a star on it. And we used it to tool around the, this now was probably after the war, after this, and so we used it to tool around the neighborhood with. And when we got our whole unit, which I and four other guys was, and I can't believe to this day that they left just us to guard all of our equipment and turn it over to some replacements that were going to take it and go to the war in the Pacific. So the five of us, for a few days, were just there all by ourselves as far as the military was concerned. And when it came time for us to, when the other group came, then we took this car down to the Burgomaster and traded it to him for five loaves of bread, five bottles of cognac, and 10 hard-boiled eggs. And then we went down and got on to a boxcar, 48 boxcar, and rode it down to Marseille. And that's where we departed to come back to the United States.
So in other words, your whole platoon left earlier, when you say your unit, you mean just your team in your tank team?
No. Our whole unit.
And left. Tell me again what the whole unit means, all of your company?
Yes.
So your whole company left, except for the five men that were on your tank?
No. Well, there were five of us, not necessarily from our tank.
Okay, which five were left behind?
Well, I was the first sergeant at that time.
Okay.
So that was the master sergeant of the group. And then we had a couple maintenance men, and then I guess just a couple other guys for guard duty or something.
And how long were you there by yourselves, the five of you?
Oh, I would guess a couple weeks.
So you would have had, let's see if my math is right, you would have had about 36 tanks there?
I suppose, yeah.
So that was quite a bit of equipment to leave you guys with, wasn't it?
I can't believe to this day why there wasn't a whole bunch of officers left there, you know, to look after things. But no, they just left it. I was the head honcho.
How did you feel being the head honcho for those couple of weeks?
Oh, I just we were happy. We were living comfortably.
Now, when your company moved into, what town was this in where you last were in Austria?
It seems like it was Rödi of some type.
Okay. Company came into Austria. Where would the civilians go when you took over their homes?
We were pretty liberal with them. The most of them stayed right there.
So a lot of them would stay in the same homes you would be in?
We weren't in a cleaning out escapade of any type. We just moved in with them, really, what happened.
Tell me about when you got on a train to go back to Marseille, the five of you. It was just a regular passenger train?
Oh, no, it was a boxcar.
That's what you said. Well, so what does that mean?
40 and 8. Did you ever hear of the 40 and 8?
No.
That was the transportation that was used in Germany and France. And all it was boxcars, and when they got to 48th, a boxcar was supposed to hold 40 people or 8 horses, and that's where they got to 48th. We just got on the boxcar.
What else was in the boxcar with you?
Nothing.
Nothing, it was empty.
Just us. As we went along, we picked up a couple guys here and there. Just looked out the doors.
Were you able to stop along the way to go to the bathroom and get food?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, there was an organized route of some type, because I can remember we stopped a couple different places, and everybody got off the train and went through. They had food place set up, so we got something to eat. So I guess it must have been a semi-organized train trip or something. But anyway, we wound up at Marseille.
And how long was the ship from Marseille back to the States?
Oh, I imagine it was a couple of weeks.
And where did you go to after that?
We landed in New York, I guess, one of the harbors there. And then I went to, from there, then I went to Camp McCoy, Wisconsin. That's where we from the Midwest were sent to be discharged.
Okay.
And so I was discharged at Fort McCoy, Camp McCoy. It's Fort McCoy now, but Camp McCoy at that time. And came back to Lisbon.
And what month would that have been in?
October.
October of 1945.
Yep. It took us quite a while to get out of Marseille.
Did it?
Because there was, at that time, the railroad people were on strike. And so they were wanting any military men that had railroad experience, they wanted them back in the States. So they had top priority of getting back to the States. So I suppose we hung around Marseille for a month or so, probably just waiting for transportation. But anyway, I wound up at Camp McCoy and was discharged there in October. And then I came home to Lisbon, and I was just home for or 10 days, I guess, and I re-enlisted the Army.
So tell me about your homecoming to Lisbon. Was anybody waiting for you? Did you take a train to Lisbon? Was there a train?
No. Three or four of us rented a cab from Camp McCoy, Wisconsin to Lisbon, and we were all from Lisbon. So that's how we got there.
So there were three or four men from Lisbon in your company or in your battalion?
Battalion.
In your battalion. And so you rented a cab?
Yeah.
Seriously?
Yes.
Do you remember how much it cost to take a cab?
No idea.
So you rented a cab from McCoy, Fort McCoy,
Wisconsin,
to Lisbon.
Lisbon.
And that would have been about an 8 or 9 hour drive, 10 hour drive?
Oh, it would have been 8 hours anyway. It would have been about 8 hours.
Were your parents expecting you?
Well, yes and no. I think I was pretty good on keeping them posted as to what was happening to me. So I'm sure that they would expect me to come in any day, which I did. And I remember my mother, the first meal I had at home, my dad did his own butchering, and he wasn't much of a butcher, but he got the job done, and he always had pork chops that were so thick, and they were just delicious. And my mother had she must have known, and I don't know how this happened. But anyway, for my first meal at home, I remember was we had those pork chops, and we had glorified rice, and she had saved. And I never told her this, but we used to, in our tank, when we'd get rations, it was hard to have individuals. A lot of times we got a bunch of stuff. And I can remember them several times throwing a number 10 can of fruit cocktail on our tank. And so I was so tired of fruit cocktail. And so my mother had, during the years there, she had gotten a can of fruit cocktail and was saving it. So when I came home, she opened that can of fruit cocktail. I never did tell her, you know.
That must have been a pretty divine dinner besides the fruit cocktail.
It was, yeah. I always remember that.
Now tell me about your brothers. Were they in World War II?
Yes, they were. One of them was, well, in fact, I ran into one of them in Italy, so I'd seen him. And then there was one that was he was in some communications unit, and south of Florida, some of those islands there. And then my youngest brother was in the Navy, and he went to the Pacific Theater.
Did he make it back alive?
Oh, yes, we all got back, yeah.
All four of you did?
Yeah.
Now, there were five boys, weren't there, in your family?
Well, yeah, my oldest brother was on the farm.
On the farm.
Married, a child.
Okay, so all four of you made it back alive, which was pretty amazing.
Yes.
And tell me about when you ran into your brother in Italy.
Well, I guess I really don't know how. I don't know how it came about, except I knew what unit he was in, and we met in, I suppose it was Naples probably. We didn't spend that much time together. Didn't have that much time. But what do? We went to the bar and had a few drinks. And, I remember he got a haircut from some Italian. But otherwise, we didn't spend that much time together. We didn't have that much time, really.
Now, this is when you first arrived in Naples, or when you came back to Naples after being up in Florence?
No, I think this would have been when we first got to Naples.
And when you say unit, do you mean battalion, or what do you mean when you say unit?
Well, I think primarily of our company.
Your company.
Yeah.
So he was in the same battalion, but a different company?
No. He was a different type of a unit altogether.
And how were you able to communicate with him that you knew he was in Italy?
I don't honestly know. I suppose through our parents, probably. I told him that somehow I was able to tell him. Well, they knew what unit I was in, but I don't think you could tell where you were at. But of course, you had your unit address, and then Marv, of course, if he corresponded at home, had a unit address also. So I guess probably my folks gave Marv's unit to me, and they gave my unit to Marv. So I was able to track him down in that respect.
Going back to World War II, what would you say was your most memorable experience in World War II? If you could think of all the things that we talked about or something that we did not talk about, what was the most memorable experience?
Oh, I think probably going into Rome was a high point. Even though we didn't have much activity there, didn't get involved that much, but just the idea of it. We'd all heard of Rome, but never had any idea of being there, you know. And so, I guess when I look back, that was quite an exciting experience. And after we'd gone beyond Rome a ways, we had a break in action. And that's when our lieutenant got shot. He was in the hospital in Rome. And so four or five of us got a jeep and went back to Rome to visit him. And so that was kind of an exciting time. You know. Things were great. Drank a lot of wine again.
How many days off did you have off?
Oh, just a couple.
A couple days?
Yeah.
And how far north were you up?
Oh, I don't think we were probably, we weren't 7,500 miles or something. Yeah.
And how did the lieutenant end up doing?
Fine, he came back to us.
He did. What was his name?
Adler Bratlett.
Okay. So that must have been a pretty exciting experience
yes,
to take
it
a
was.
Few days off from action and go to Rome.
Yeah.
And did you see the Vatican in Rome or anything?
Oh, yes. We went to Vatican. But I was not that. Oh, I don't know. Excited about it or something. The other guys were Catholics, you know, and they, of course, were really thrilled about that. And of course, I guess I was too, but I couldn't do some of the things that they did. But, you know, but it was interesting to see the Vatican.
And you were raised Lutheran, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. All right. Any other experiences you want to share with me?
I guess that incident of the automobile and us getting back to Marseille would be a highlight.
Okay.
And I don't think I heard any of it. I was just getting along.
And what would you love for people to know about World War II that didn't serve in World War II, especially young people today?
I guess somehow or another, make them get them to realize what a dangerous situation we were in. And our attempt to try to, well, we did accomplish it, do something about it. It was not an easy, I don't know, it didn't bother me that much, but it was not an easy time, I'm sure, for a lot of young fellows that were drafted that wanted no part of the army, but yet they had it. But there's been so much cruel stuff going on since then too, that Hitler probably was a little patsy compared to some of the activities that are going on now. I don't know. It's just a tragic thing.
Speaking of Hitler, did you know anything about the concentration camps when you were there in Germany or in Europe at all?
We liberated a concentration camp. And I don't remember which one it was, and I don't remember exactly where it was. But I can remember us driving our tank. It was a barbed wire enclosure, like you see pictures of, you know. And I remember driving our tank right through the gates and knocking down the posts, you know, and the German guards, of course, flew. They moved on. And one of our guys wasn't in my tank, but one of our guys found his brother there. And that was an emotional incident, you know. And he was so thin and so sickly, I guess is the term, that he was being evacuated to a hospital in England, and they took his brother that was in our outfit, they took had him accompany him over to Europe. There were Johnson brothers from down around the Winebear area here in North Dakota.
What was it called? The name of the town?
Winebear.
Winebear?
Yeah.
Okay. So why was his brother in a was this a POW camp or a
POW camp.
Oh, it was a POW camp.
Yeah.
Okay.
You said concentration camp. POW camp.
It was a POW camp, and how many POWs were there about?
Oh, I have no idea. There was a lot of them.
That must have been a pretty amazing feeling.
It was.
Did you know in advance that you were coming upon a POW camp, or you just came upon it?
We just came upon it.
And was this after May 8th?
Or? Oh, no. This would have been... Early 45, I suppose.
So you actually, you were able to get all the POWs out?
Well, I have no idea. We broke down the barricades.
Yep.
And there was a little village over on the horizon. I guess I'd probably say a mile away or something like that. And I remember these POWs streaming out of the camp and heading towards that village up there. Now, what happened when they got up there, I don't know.
How long were you there at the POW camp?
Oh, we were just there a short period. We had, in a tank outfit, we always had a big box or a couple boxes strapped onto the back of the tank where we kept extra rations, extra cigarettes and things, and so of course we handed those out. I don't know whatever developed after that.
And what about the concentration camps? Did you guys know anything about what was happening to the Jews by the Germans?
Oh, I think we probably heard about it, but I can't remember during the war of having that much information.
What about when you were in Austria? Did you hear anything in Austria about it?
No, not really.
When did you find out about what were the concentration camps?
I think news after World War, after the war, probably.
When you got back to the States?
Yeah.
Were there any other kind of wild times that you didn't tell me, or funny things that happened?
In North Africa, you know, we were all issued, or given, whatever you want to call it, two mattress covers. And the theory was that we were to stuff those with straw or hay and use them for beds, you know. But we always thought, you know, that's what they were used for a lot. I say, well, simply body bags. We were carrying our own body bags. And we used to, when we were on a break after the African campaign, of course, we had a period there that we were just goofing off, so to speak. And we'd get in a Jeep and take those mattress covers and drive out into the desert. Wave one of those, you know, somebody would come out of the woods or out of the sand, and we'd sell them to the natives for, I think it was $20, and So we did a lot of that. We weren't supposed to, of course.
And if you had been caught doing that, what would have happened to you?
Oh, I don't know what would have happened. For some reason, we were all smokers and drinkers. Every place we went, we drank wine.
That was pretty common in the 1940s, wasn't it,
yeah,
to smoke?
Oh, yes. Well, you know, we were, every time you got rations, you got a package of cigarettes.
And how often did you get rations?
Daily.
Daily. And you got a package of cigarettes every day?
Yeah.
Wow. Were there any guys that didn't smoke?
Well, there were some, and I didn't smoke that much. I gave most of mine away.
Do you remember how much they paid you in the military in World War II?
Yeah, when I went in, it was $21 a month.
Okay.
And
did you ever have moments when you came across Germans and you were not in a battle that you would just go past them and not fight each other? Like in North Africa.
Well, if they were surrendering, of course, we just let them through our lines.
Okay.
You know, that happened more than once.
And if they were surrendering and you let them through their lines, did you make sure they didn't have any weapons on them?
Well, they generally, well, yes, we made it. We didn't pat them down or anything like that, but they didn't have rifles or pistols that were visible. No, that never happened in Africa, as far as I was concerned. But I think of an instance in towards the end of the war in Germany, I suppose it was, where our bombers were, I think they were bombing those oil fields of Pelosi or some such thing as that. And on their way back, of course, they were flying low, and some of them get crippled up, you know, and the crew would bail out. And of course, you'd see the parachutes. And a couple instances, I can remember this. Paratrooper landed amongst a group of Germans, and it wasn't long before they were waving a white flag, and he brought a whole bunch of German soldiers with him to surrender. He wanted to come back to our lines, of course, but then he brought a bunch of German prisoners with him. And they were just waiting for somebody to help them surrender to the American troops. You heard a lot of that.
So he was just by himself as a paratrooper.
Oh, yeah.
And he was bailing out of an airplane, yeah, landed amongst a bunch of Germans who were waiting to surrender.
Yes.
And he just brought up out of them back the lines.
Yeah.
And out of what, where was this out of, do you think?
It was towards the end of the war, but in Germany, I suppose.
And you heard a lot of stories like this, where solo...
Oh, I've seen, you know, half a dozen instances.
How close were you to the paratrooper when he came down?
Oh, five, six blocks, I suppose, or something like that.
And so, what, did you actually see him come down in his parachute?
Yep.
And what else did you witness?
Well, then shortly after that, there was a white flag came up. Apparently, these Germans were in a excavation of some type, or bunker of some type. And of course, they were waiting to surrender, I think, but didn't know how to go about it. I'm guessing that's what they were. But anyway, they. One group I remember, it must have been 15, 20 of them, that came out with this paratrooper.
And this was right out in front of you?
Oh, yeah, right, yeah.
Weren't you surprised?
Well, I was surprised. In fact, I knew that they were, well, about five or six blocks, maybe a little further than that. I knew that there was a bunch of troops there. But I was trying to, we were in a wooded area, and I was trying to make up my mind whether we wanted to blast them out of there or what we do, you know. And while we were trying to make up our mind, these paratroopers came in. So we could have really raised havoc with it by firing into the compound. I'm glad we didn't.
Why are you glad you didn't?
Well, boy, that was, it was our enemy, but I thought we were taking an unfair advantage of them. We had a tank, and heavy, big weapons, and that was just murdering them, really, and I didn't wish to care about that aspect of it. I was much more happier when they surrendered.
And how many of you were in the woods? How many tanks were in the woods deciding what to do?
About four of us.
Four tanks? And do you remember what month this was approximately?
No.
Was it cold out or was it springtime?
I'm thinking it was, it must have been towards the end of the war.
Okay.
So it must have been springtime.
And was it just one paratrooper that came out of the airplane or was there another one?
There was two or three of them scattered around, but this guy here was right out in front of us.
And he was the only one that brought in these 15 or 20 German soldiers. And you saw this happen more than once?
Oh, yes. You heard many stories of Germans wanting to surrender, but they wanted to surrender to us, not to the Russians. Pretty roughly. I have no knowledge of this, but I just always felt that probably we were pretty good to the PWs that we had.
Do you have any sense of how far away the Russians were when you were in Germany towards the end? But did you, at that time, did you understand that the Russians would have treated them worse, or you understood this later on?
No. We always heard that.
You heard that they would treat them poorly?
Yeah. If they were going to surrender, they wanted to surrender to us rather than the Russians.
How many times do you think you had POWs come in front of your tanks to surrender? How often did that happen? Like a dozen times during the course of war, or more than that, or less than that?
No, less than that. Half a dozen times, probably.
Half a dozen times?
That's about it, I guess.
Thank you very, very much. You've been most wonderful, and I appreciate all your time.
That's no problem. Happy to do it.
Thank you.
I've never had a opportunity, I guess, or whatever you want to call it. I've never talked about World War II. When we used to have these reunions, I very seldom ever talked about the rough times we had. It was always wild things like this, like that car incident or something like that we got involved in.